I'm sure you've heard the old proverb that the difference between a pessimist and an optimist is this. A pessimist sees the cup as half empty, but the optimist sees it as one that is half full. Maybe you've also heard it put like this. A realist is a former idealist who has been mugged by reality. In other words, he has seen the dark side of life. And then again, there are those that frequently see the dark side of humanity. Doctors, policemen, counselors, preachers. And then other people, they see a lot of the darkness just in their life or in their family, and they go through life pessimistic. I'm reminded of a cartoon character many years ago that wandered into Little Abner occasionally, Joe Benifstick, and he always had a cloud above him with lightning and rain. Wherever he went, it followed him. He was a pessimist. The book of Ecclesiastes sometimes looks very pessimistic and gloomy. Today we look at the first six verses of chapter 4, and these are some of the gloomiest verses in the whole Bible. Solomon is somewhat like Job. He's going through a tough time, and he's pessimistic. He's gloomy. He's sad. He's depressed. Many of us know what that's like to go through a time where it's just you're in a cloud and you're wondering, is there sunshine behind this cloud? When, oh Lord? But as we've said week by week as we go through Ecclesiastes, life is gloomy. But we need to have a higher perspective. God's principles and promises move us from being under the cloud to seeing the sunshine behind the cloud. So it is a matter of perspective. This morning's lesson breaks down to 3 points on these 6 verses. And the first one is to be found in verse 1. I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors, there is power. Now notice the same word used in 3 different ways. Oppression, oppressed, and oppressors. And the word in Hebrew in the Old Testament means someone that is oppressing someone else unfairly for dishonest gain. It might be done legally, it might be done illegally, but as it says here, they have power on their side, and they use it to squeeze people, to threaten them unfairly. And Solomon says, this isn't right. We saw it previously in the previous chapter, verse 16, about social and civil injustice. Turn the page over to chapter 5. We're going to get to this verse in a couple of weeks. Chapter 5, verse 8. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in the province, do not marvel at the matter. High officials, watches over high official, and higher officials are over them. So he looked around, even in his own palace, and saw oppression. The illegal or legal power pressure to cheat people. And it can be on the street corner, or it can be in high places, but it's all around us. And the person does it for power, for glory, and often for money. Let me give you a few illustrations of how I learned about it. 3 illustrations from my family. First, when I was in 3rd grade, my older brother had just started 7th grade, and he went to a different school, and he learned in his very first week the meaning of the word bullies. You see, in grammar school, everybody was friends. But when he went to this other school, some of the tough boys would take him aside and push him and threaten him. And they'd say, you give us your lunch money or we're going to punch you in the face. And he got beat up a few times and would come home bruised and crying. And you see that and you say, that's not fair. That's the sort of oppression Solomon sees. And then I learned that sometimes this happens even in businesses. My father worked for a rather large company, and he was, I guess you'd say, middle management. And it wasn't the way it used to be. And there was word going around with some of the new executives that they said, well, we want to save money. And so they passed the word kind of indirectly, nothing written down, that if a man had worked for the company for so many years and had been a good worker and is entitled to a pension, look for some excuse to let him go before he retires and you don't have to pay him the pension anymore. And my father heard about that and he walked into those men's offices and said, that's not fair. I'm not going to do your dirty work. We're not going to oppress these men. They've got a pension coming to them. And the men above them would listen to my dad. And I said, good for my dad. We need people like that that'll stand up against oppression. And then I learned about it when I was, 18 years old. And I hasten to add, I wasn't a Christian yet. I was an old-fashioned hippie, and me and two other guys would do these flashing light shows at dances and parties and small-town concerts. We didn't make much, maybe $25 to split three ways. And I remember we did a light show for a band that wanted to win the Battle of the Bands competition. So we made them look good. And sure enough, they won. And afterwards, I said, well, we got our $25. We packed up our equipment. I went up to the manager, who was actually younger than me. And I went up and said, well, you won. And he said, so? And I said, well, where's our $25? He looked at me and he laughed and he cursed and said, no deal. You're not getting any money. And I said, what's the deal? And he said, well, get out of here. And he cursed me again. And I said, that's not fair. And I almost took my coat off and dragged him outside and let him have it. I wasn't a Christian yet. But I said, this guy's cheating me and he knows it. And then Justin, who worked with us, who was kind of a tough guy, he grabbed me. He says, oh, don't touch that guy. And I said, I can take him easily. He said, no. He pulled me aside and he whispered just one word in my ear. Mafia. And I said, he's too young to be in the mafia, Justin. He says, his dad's not too young to be in the mafia. Kurt, let it lie. Didn't you know that? He does this all the time. He cheats and he gets away with it. And I remember thinking, that's not fair. I wonder if that guy grew up and joined the mafia. That's what the mafia is all about. Squeezing, extortion, protection. You pay them insurance or your business gets burnt down. Oppression. It's not fair. People cheat. What about identity thieves? Be on the lookout. And then you look at it in high places, as Solomon did. And often what happens is, in an oppressed society, the poor people, as it says here, are weeping, free us from the oppressors. And here comes another group, the liberators. And they say, side with us and you will be free of oppression. And the crowds rally behind them and they overthrow the Tsar, for example. And then they find out the communists were worse than the Tsar that they overthrew. Read your history book. It goes back to the specter that was haunting Europe back in the 18th century. Look at the Bourbon dynasty in France. Wealthy. Getting wealthy over the backs of the poor in France. And here come the liberators. We will free you. And they had the French Revolution. And within 10 years, it was worse than before because Robespierre brought in the reign of terror and there was literally blood in the gutters of Paris. In the reign of terror. And that paved the way for the little general named Napoleon to come in as a ruthless dictator. And the French were saying, it's worse than it was before. We were promised fraternité, égalité, liberté. And now it's worse than before. Or, back in Cuba in the 1950s, Fulgencio Batista, corrupt government, had the police on his side taking bribes and making threats. And the poor Cuban said, freedom, freedom. And here comes a man with a beard from the mountains saying, we will free you. His name was Fidel Castro. And within a few years, the people were saying things like, and you'd have to know the Hispanic mindset, they said, we have learned the hard lesson that it'd be better to be kicked with one boot than to be jumped on with two boots. And he found out the liberators were worse than the previous oppressors. Well, I could go on and on and on citing examples, and you probably know examples in your life. Children learn it early in life from bullies, and we learn it in business, government, and elsewhere. And Solomon learned this lesson 3,000 years ago. Look at the verse again. The tears of the oppressed. People are weeping, crying out, and they're saying, doesn't anybody care? Let me read you a verse where someone else felt like this. David, in the book of Psalms, he was on the run, and he cried out to God. Psalm 42, I will say to God, my rock, why have you forgotten me? Why do I go mourning because of the oppression of the enemy? As with the breaking of the bones, my enemies reproach me all day long and say, where is your God? You ever feel like that? Not just a bad blue Monday, but you're oppressed at work where someone lies about you so he gets the promotion. Or you even get fired and you go home weeping. It's not fair. And Solomon says, but they have no comforter. Now let's get the higher perspective. There is a comforter. God sees the tears of the oppressors, of the oppressed. He hears their groans and their cries. And as we saw last week, nobody really ever gets away with crime. Nobody ever really gets away with oppression. The dictators, the bullies will all have to answer to God one day. And then there's another oppression. The great oppressor is Satan. Look that up in the New Testament where it often says Jesus healed those that were oppressed by the devil. He is behind all civil injustice, crime, murder. He is the great bully, as it were. And he'll answer to Jesus Christ one day. Christ will set everything straight one day. Nobody gets away with oppression. Now here's another lesson before we move on. Let's look in the mirror and make sure we're not the oppressors. You say, well, Pastor Daniel, I'm not in a position where I can oppress anybody. I'm not a bully. There are subtle ways that we take advantage of other people and then we justify it. Let's look into the mirror and make sure we're not the one. It'd be better to be oppressed than to be the oppressor. I've always liked the story of the great Puritan Matthew Henry. And he wrote a great Bible commentary people are still reading today. Once he was traveling in a stagecoach out in the country, and an old-fashioned highway robber rode up on a horse, had a long cloak, had a mask, comes and pulls an old-fashioned musket and says, give me your money or I shoot you. And so Matthew Henry emptied his pockets and gave him the silver, and the man rode off. And Matthew Henry, being very wise, immediately took out quill pen and wrote down 10 lessons to be learned from this. One of them is, well, he took my money, but he didn't take my life. He did this, and then the last one was, I thank God that it was him that robbed me and not me that robbed him. Let's search our hearts that we're not the oppressors cheating people. And as I said, it's very easy to slide into this and to justify it. Let me give you a little parable and you'll see the point. Let's say you're playing baseball. You can be a little boy or you could be a grown man on our softball team. And it's the bottom of the ninth, in the ninth inning of the game. The score is tied and you're up to bat and it's two outs. And the call is 3 balls, 2 strikes. Now, if you know anything about baseball, the bases are loaded. Full count. If you get a ball, you go to first base, everybody advances, the guy on third base comes home, you win the game. But if you get a strike and you don't swing, you're out, it goes to extra inning, the other team's up to bat, they could probably win the game. Okay, you got the setting. So there you are, batting, and here comes the ball. And the umpire says, ball 4! And your team jumps out of the dugout cheering, we won, because everybody advances. And the other team, especially the pitcher and the catcher, says, ball nothing, that was a strike! And they're saying, that's not fair! And they're yelling. And you know it was a strike. And you know the umpire called it wrong. And if you turned to him and said, excuse me, umpire, it was a strike. I'm out. Everybody has to get off the base. You know, if you do that, your manager is going to yell at you and all your teammates are going to say, what are you doing? You just threw the game. What would you do if you were in that situation? We often face ethical challenges like that at work, and we can easily justify it. You see, if you say, that's right, ump, it was a ball, and you knew that it was a strike, you have just robbed the other team of a game. You have become the oppressor instead of the oppressed. So learn the lesson. God is watching, and God is listening. The next lesson is found in verses 2 and 3, and I'll tell you now, these are two of the gloomiest verses in the whole Bible. But notice what he says at the beginning. He says, therefore I praise the dead. In the light of this oppression, I'm praising the dead. I'm envying them. I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who is still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work, such as this oppression that is done under the sun. That's gloominess. Here he speaks about three people. Number one, the people that once lived and now they're dead. Secondly, those people that are alive now but one day will die. And thirdly, people that have not even been born but one day will be born. And he says, which ones are better? Well, he says, the worst are the ones that are still alive suffering this oppression. Better than those are the ones that have already died. They're not here. But he says, I envy the people that are not even born and may never get born. That's gloomy. He's pessimistic. You see, he's looking at the dark side of life and he's going through this sadness, this gut-wrenching worry about the gloomy side of life. That's what you read about in the life of Job and Jeremiah, for example, Job chapter 3, chapter 10, Jeremiah chapter 20. Then you find other people, David going through a really bad time and saying, it's not fair what I'm going through. I'm on God's side. Why do the righteous suffer and the unrighteous get away with it? They're the oppressors and they weep and say, it's not fair. It's not fair. And then they begin to say, life's not fair. Or to put it in modern parlance, we sometimes go through this emotional experience when everything seems to be going against us. Now other people, they're getting away with it. And we say things like, it's not getting any better. I wish I'd never been born. You ever said that? That's what Solomon's feeling here. I envy the people that are never born. I wish I'd never been born. Now, we hear that line every Christmas when we watch the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, and George Bailey gets to see what life is like. If he had never been born, he ends up happy, but sometimes people say, I wish I'd never been born. It can't get any worse, and the next day it seems to get worse. And then they don't say, I wish I'd never been born, like Solomon, they say, and I've heard this, where they say, I wish I was dead. That's what Solomon is thinking here. It's almost like he is contemplating suicide. I wish I'd never been born. Is there any way out of this? I just wish I was gone. David once said, I wish I was a bird that flew out of the cage and was gone. I just wish I was out of this. I wish I could go to sleep and wake up and it's all behind me. Then he wakes up and finds out it's still there. Person that reaches this stage begins to consider suicide. But I would remind you, God doesn't allow suicide. He is the giver and the taker of life. And through the darkest valleys of gloom and despair, such as what Solomon went, we need to have that higher perspective. And I don't want to sound like Pollyanna saying, well, just sing a little song and put a smile on your face. It's going to get better, you know, behind every dark cloud, there's a silver lining. It doesn't always get better in this life. But God offers to walk with us through the valley, not only the valley of the shadow of death, but the canyon of despair and depression. You see, a canyon can be so deep, even the sunshine doesn't shine down there. Some of us know what that's like day by day, and you say, it's gloomy. I just want out of this. Wish I'd never been born. Wish I was dead. turn to God. And at those deep moments, we say, is life really worth living? When I was a boy, there was a television show. He was one of the first television preachers. And it wasn't an evangelical. It was a Catholic bishop named Cardinal Archbishop Fulton J. Sheen. I don't know if any of y'all remember him. He looked kind of dangerous, but he had this television show, and every time he'd walk up and look right at the camera and say, God is alive and life is worth living. Now, I don't agree with everything else he said, but he had a good point. God is alive and life is worth living if you know God. If you don't know God, you'll only see the gloomy side of life and say, life isn't worth living. I wish I'd never been born. Life is worth living if you know God. And that's the higher perspective that we'll find later with Solomon. You see, without God, life is a nightmare. It's gloominess. And there's no justice, only oppression. And we find like we're going through a dark and dangerous jungle, fighting animals of despair and oppression. Get the higher perspective. God's not fool. He's still in control. He'll set everything right. But if we don't see it from God's perspective, then we get gloomy in our own life. For example, in a way, this is the most philosophic book in the Bible. And secular psychology and philosophy sometimes echoes this without getting the higher perspective in the answer. For example, for many years, the most popular philosophy was called existentialism. This reigned from the late 40s after the war and the gloominess of the worst war in history up until the 1970s. And then it became postmodernism. But existentialism goes through the gut-wrenching process saying, there is no hope, everything is gloomy, live for the moment. That's the only meaning in life. And one of their philosophers wrote a book called No Exit. Sounded like Solomon. There's no way out of this. It's gloominess, darkness, despair. And the author ended up committing suicide. Existentialism not only leads to postmodernism, you make your own truth, you make your own ethics, but it often ends in another philosophy called nihilism. What's that? It comes from the Latin word nihil, meaning nothing. Life has no meaning. And that philosophy almost inevitably leads to not only despair, but death. There's no meaning in life. Maybe there's meaning in death. And that's why Solomon here is saying, I praise the dead that were already dead. And I can't wait to get out of here. But there is an exit. There is a different perspective. True meaning in life is to be found in knowing God. I keep saying that every week because that's the theme of the book of Ecclesiastes. And we need to share it with people. Like Dell and his crew sharing it down there at the Mardi Gras parade in St. Louis. People think you find meaning in life in a bottle or in sex or in drugs, politics, fun, whatever. That won't help. People are setting up their own gods, and they find their gods do not satisfy. Our God does. He is the real God. He is the God of life, love, meaning, and truth. And when we look up and see things from His perspective, when we trust Him, we are like Job, that God will vindicate and see us through the canyon of darkness. But we need to see it from His perspective. David did. Oh, you read some of his gloomy psalms, but he keeps turning to God where he says, yet I will hope in you. Read Psalm 73. I read it in my devotions recently. And he said, cries out to God because of the oppression he was facing. And he says, Lord, why do the righteous suffer and the unrighteous get away with it? It's not fair. And then he says this. This is a golden verse. He turns the corner. He says, then I went into your temple and I saw their end. What does that mean? He saw that they may seem to be getting away with oppression and sin now, but one day they'll face God. He says, I only saw it when I was in your temple. And then he said, I saw they're on their way to hell. I'm on my way to heaven. I'm on the winning team. Brethren, that's the hope, that's the encouragement we need to have when we look around the world and when we look around our world. Trust God. Now, these verses have an echo in the New Testament. For example, where it says, I envy those that are now dead. Sometimes Christians say, Pastor, it's really rough. I just want to go to heaven. Not so much I just want to get out of this life, but you're beginning to see heaven is a far, far better place. The verse that echoes this is in Philippians 1, where Paul says, I long to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. It is. Brethren, we've got a wonderful world waiting for us. It's not a valley of tears, but it's a place of joy, happiness, and dancing. But there's a second verse that echoes this, where he says, better is the one that has never existed than the one that is now sees the evil work that is done under the sun. Do you know the echo of that in the New Testament? Luke 22, where Jesus said, the Son of Man goes as has been foreordained of him, but woe to the man by whom he is betrayed. That's Judas. And then listen to what he said. It would be better for him not to have been born. It would be better if Judas had never existed or even died in a miscarriage than to grow up in a life of sin and reject Jesus and end up going to hell. Better not to exist than to exist and go to hell. That's the higher perspective that the New Testament offers us. Our closing section is verses 4-6. Again, I saw that for all the toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. And this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. We'll get to verses 5 and 6 in a moment. He now turns to another aspect of life in this broken world. Let me explain what I meant by that. You parents need to talk to your children when they're very young and say, now, you're going to go through life, and life's not always fair. There are going to be bullies. There are going to be people who cheat in class, and they get the A and you don't. And they're going to get this at work and you don't. Life isn't always fair. And they say, why is it like this? Because we're living in a broken world with broken people. We're all sinners, nudging each other out, fighting, stabbing in the back, cheating. We're living in a circus of injustice. Tell your children that and say, expect to be treated unfairly, and then tell them, but God will never treat you unfairly. God is just. God is wise. Let's go through life in God's way, not in the world's way. So Solomon looks at this broken world and he sees envy here. He says every skilled work is envied by his neighbor. It's a dog-eat-dog world. Grass is greener on the other side of the fence, you think. And by envy, he means you want something that somebody else has. And he'll address this later. You're never satisfied with that, even if you get that promotion. You get that higher allowance. You win the lottery, whatever. It's not going to finally satisfy. Covetousness not. You know, they teach people that go in the Navy that if you ever, you know, your ship goes down, you're hanging on to a life preserver, and you're going to get thirsty, don't drink the salt water in the ocean. It'll make you thirstier. Covetousness is like that. You say, if I only had this, I would be happy. You see some ad on television or something, someone down the street has a new bicycle, new car, whatever. You say, I'd really be happy if I had that. No, you wouldn't. Covetousness never satisfies. And so that's why Solomon says it's vanity, grasping after the wind. Covetousness, you remember number 10 of the 10 commandments? You shall not covet anything that belongs to anybody else. People covet anything. Money, fame, beauty, talents, things. And Solomon was the richest man on earth at that time. And he is saying, envy and covetousness will never satisfy. That's the world's way. Does life only consist in things? No. Jesus addressed that. And so those that make things their God will find, as I said, their God will never satisfy. But ours does. That's the higher perspective. Look at verse 5 now. The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. What in the world does that mean? Well, Solomon had said that in various ways over in the book of Proverbs. For him, the fool is not just someone with a low IQ, but someone that does silly things, foolish things, that he should know better. But he hadn't learned even the basics of the lessons of life. And folding of his hands over in Proverbs, he says, this is a person that is lazy. Instead of going out and work for a living, he just stays at home and just gets lazy. He becomes a couch potato watching television. As they say in Scotland, he skives off the government getting easy welfare when he can go out and work. He just folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. And that phrase there means it's self-destructive. There's something worthwhile in working and getting that paycheck, but the person that just simply lives off of other people doesn't know the joy of working, like Solomon tells us in his book here. And so he consumes his own flesh. It gets worse and worse. How should we treat people like that? We'll go and look that up in the book of Proverbs. It says something like, a loaf of bread for the needy, but a rod for the back of the lazy. Well, as Paul would say in 2 Thessalonians, where he says we should help the needy, he says, if any man will not work, let him not eat. We're not called upon to subsidize the fool that folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Buddy, get a job. Now, what's the positive? Positive is to be found in verse 6. Better is a handful with quietness. Isn't that a lovely phrase? A handful of quietness rather than both hands full where you don't are finally satisfied. Let me show you some verses on this in the book of Proverbs. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 15. Psalm 37:16 says, a little that a righteous man has is better than the riches of many wicked. And Solomon said this several times. Look at Proverbs 15, verses 16 and 17. Better is a little with the fear of the Lord than great pleasure with trouble. Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a fatted calf with hatred. Turn to chapter 16, verse 8. Better is a little with righteousness than vast revenues without justice. Lastly, chapter 17, verse 1, better is a dry morsel with quietness than a house full of feasting with strife. What is he saying here? Better to be poor and content than to be wealthy and discontent. Better to be poor, righteous, and oppressed than to be unrighteous, oppressor. You see, that's a different perspective. Let me show you one more passage. So turn with me lastly to 1 Timothy chapter 6. You see, the Bible is very, very practical on these things. Rich, poor, or somewhere in between. The Bible teaches us not covetousness, but contentment. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 6, starting in verse 6. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Stop right there. The world's going to laugh at that and say, what do you mean? Get all you can, squeeze, grasp, knife each other in the back. Get as much as you can. That's happiness. No, you'll never get it like that. Verse 7, we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. In other words, you can't take it with you. And having food and clothing with these, we shall be content. Just the basics. Don't need much more than that. Those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and a snare. Boy, did Solomon know that. And into many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. That's what covetousness is. From which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But you, O man of God, flee these things. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. So what's the antidote to the quagmire of covetousness? Simply this, righteous contentment. Or as Solomon said, just a handful with quietness. Realize God has given you so much, you have the basics, and so you enjoy peace. True peace comes from contentment. The covetous person never has it. He dreams of getting more, and it's an elusive dream, or as Solomon said, it's chasing after riches. The Bible says, be free from the love of money. Learn where true riches are. And again, here's the higher perspective. True riches is not something you can put in your bank account. It's not a bag of gold. It's not a box of diamonds. True riches is not something that is tangible. It is something spiritual. For example, family, love, and most of all, God. If you are poor but know God, you're rich. But if you're rich and don't know God, you're poor. You see, that's the diametrically opposite perspective in the world. And Solomon gives us glimmers of this later in his book. And of course, the rest of the Bible tells us that. That's true riches. One more observation. Solomon not only keeps saying, this is vanity, chasing after wind, but did you notice how he started this section? He says, I looked at everything under the sun. He keeps saying that. In other words, when you look at life simply horizontally like this, all you can see is gloom, despair, unrighteousness, and oppression. And you say, it's not fair, I wish I was dead, never been born. Solomon is learning the lesson, you don't look at things under the sun, you look beyond the sun. You see things from God's perspective, and everything looks differently. In other words, you don't look at it horizontally, you look at it vertically, from the top down. And then you say, I see it much different. You see it, you see the true answer. So then instead of pessimism and gloom and despair, you have hope and the meaning of life and a godly optimism. May the Lord help all of us to learn this important lesson that Solomon is sharing with us. Let us pray. Father, in this unusual book of Ecclesiastes, you're teaching us important life lessons. Help us to learn them. Help us to trust you. Help us to see things from your perspective. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.